especially with all the craziness that's going on.
Welcome to the July Public Health Advisory Council meeting. I hope everybody's enjoying their summer so far in this nice warm weather. I know we complain when it gets a little too hot, but we'll complain when it rains too. So take what we can get, right? So I'm going to start with the roll call, and we're not going to do an icebreaker tonight because we do have kind of a lengthy agenda again tonight. So we're going to skip the icebreaker. So we'll start with Ashley.
Hi.
You're here. Brian Scarlett Fisher. Let's see. Emily. Dr. Doppin,
here.
Dr. Trom,
here.
Laura Lynn Lord,
here.
Mark Collier,
here.
Paul is not here. Robert Ferrier,
here.
And I'm here. Scott Johnson,
here.
Tracy Fernandez,
here.
The winner, the mayor, more. Tyler Clary,
here.
Danette?
Here.
Jerry Preston?
Here.
Jeff Harbison?
Here.
Dr. Brianna DeSalvio?
Here.
And Brianna Dunn?
Brianna, yep.
Here. And Valerie and Dr. Milne. All right. Well, welcome. As usual, Mallory had sent out the minutes from our last meeting, and hopefully you had a chance to look over those minutes. Does anybody have any comments, additions, corrections to those minutes? Yes.
I have a comment and a question. My first comment is to Jeff, thank you for doing budget stuff, because that's a nightmare. More power to you. I really appreciate all the details, too, to help us understand that, because it's not an easy process, especially right now. My question is about three-quarters of the way through there was something about field staff pay raises, about 15.9-something percent, which seems really high for a pay raise. Normally pay raises aren't that high, so is this from new positions being created, or were some people noted to have under-market salaries and you wanted to bring them in line, or what explains a 16% salary increase?
I'll let Jeff answer that question.
Okay. Oh, I didn't know you were going to answer that. I honestly didn't.
I can't answer.
So the year-over-year increase in the 2026 budget is actually related to agreements filed by the coalition of unions. There is 11 or 12 unions in our county. Four of them are in what's called a coalition. They filed a grievance, a Me Too clause, in the contracts of the coalition CBAs, and they were successful. And I guess I can go into detail. The grievance was around the county manager's contract. And the Me Too clause basically says if non-represented or non-union employees receive a pay raise of some size, the coalition unions get that same increase. And so they filed the grievance saying that that should count the county manager's contract as well. And they were successful. So through the mediation, and that was the outcome of the Me Too grievance. The prior budget, the county brought in Baker Tilly, the contractor, to do a salary realignment study. So there was raises related to that to get everybody to market, what market was based on Baker Tilly's analysis.
I remember that.
Yeah. And then the Baker Tilly grievance followed that. Not the Baker Tilly, the Me Too grievance
right.
followed that.
Okay.
So pretty much back-to-back years of that.
Okay. Thank you for explaining.
No problem.
Any other comments or questions or changes that need to be made? Okay. I need a motion to move to approve the minutes.
So moved.
Okay. Second?
Second.
All those in favor of approving the minutes from our June meeting, say aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? All right, our minutes have been accepted. All right, tonight we have Brianna Dannon with us, who's going to do a little presentation on immunization program and an update on that, and this will be the presentation to the Board of Health meeting tomorrow. So I'm gonna turn it over to Brianna.
Okay, perfect. But I was going to hop over here so you guys can all see me and aren't having to crane your necks for me. So let me, you can still advance. Yeah. Is that okay?
Yes.
Okay. Perfect. But I'll sit up here.
All
Well, thank you all for having me today to present on this topic to you all. It's been kind of a hot topic, immunizations in general, right? So I'm excited to give you guys an update on what's going on here in Clark County. I'm Brianna Bannon. I'm our public health nurse with our immunizations program. And I'll have you do the next slide here. So just a quick overview of what I'm going to talk about today. I wanted to touch on immunization rates with you, and we'll cover both school data trends as well as trends from the Washington State Immunization Information System, which is our registry here in Washington State. And then we'll talk a little bit about immunization program projects that we've been working on to address immunization rates. Next slide. So before we get going, I wanted to give you guys a little bit of background on immunizations in general, and then our immunization rate system, so you guys have a little bit better understanding of what we're talking about when we talk about the rates here. So just as a background, I'm going to talk about school immunization rates. So school immunizations, in Washington State, there are immunizations that children are required to have for child care and school attendance. The reason that we have these requirements is because it helps to reduce disease occurrence. It also reduces the number of outbreaks that we see in school settings from these diseases. Immunizations also reduce disease severity and prevent poor outcomes from these diseases. And then these requirements also help to connect children to healthcare in our community. Whether they're getting immunized or getting an exemption, they do need to see a healthcare provider, so that helps connect them to care. So school immunization requirements can be met by submitting their immunization records or an exemption form to the local school district where their child's going to attend, or to a child care center, but we're going to focus on school data with my presentation. When those records are submitted, school nurses track these records in a system to help them see what status children fall into. And there's four different statuses that children can have. They can be complete. That means that they've received all recommended and required immunizations for school attendance. They can be exempt, which means that they have an exemption on file for one or more vaccines that are required for school attendance. They can be conditional, and what that means is they're on a catch-up schedule. They've gotten all the vaccines they can currently get, and they're just kind of waiting until that next dose is due, or they're old enough to get that next dose. Or they can be out of compliance, meaning that they haven't met those requirements. Typically, kids who are out of compliance are excluded from school or child care attendance, but I'll talk about our rates here. Things got a little messy this last year because a lot of our schools changed systems, and so there was a grandfathering that if they were in compliance in the previous system, they're allowed to still attend school. So we didn't have a lot of kids that were out of school because of that this last year. So next slide here. So looking at our school data, what I chose to pull out of here because it was the least messy of all of our data is our kindergarten exemption data to share with you guys. So you can see on the slide here, in the 2024-2025 school year, Clark County was at a 9.3% exemption rate for kindergarten immunizations. This is compared to the Washington State rate, which was 4.8%.
Brianna, does that mean one out of every 10 kindergartners has an exemption?
Correct, yeah.
Okay.
And that also means there are still kids that fall into those other categories, so there could be some kids that are out of compliance, some kids that are conditional, so that also doesn't mean that almost 91% of kids are complete. Our actual completion rate is a little bit lower than that, but this was the cleanest number to share with you guys. I chose to focus on kindergartners because kindergartners were coming into school this year, so the schools didn't have to deal with the whole record transition, so it was that cleaner data that they were getting entered into the new system.
Can I ask a question?
Yep.
What did they get an exemption for?
So I will talk about the types of exemption here, yeah, in just a second. So, okay, so those are our rates and where we're at, and we can see that our exemptions for kindergartners have been rising too over the last few years. So next slide here. So this slide shows the breakdown for K through 12 exemptions. On here, we do see that little bit of messy data. That exemptions just didn't make it into the new system. So it looks like we had a drop, but I would expect the next year or two as that data gets cleaned up that we'll see our exemptions back up to where they were the previous school year in 2023-2024 for K through 12. And so on here, you can see our breakdown by exemption type. So we've actually seen our religious, which is in orange there at the top, and I don't know why my numbers didn't show up on there, but religious exemptions for Clark County were at 3% exemption rate. In the blue right below that is our personal exemptions, which are at 2.1%. The black dotted line is our medical exemptions, which are at just 0.5%. And then the religious membership exemption is in the yellow dashed line at the bottom there, and that was at 0.5% as well.
What's the difference?
So the difference, yep, you're queuing me up here. So the difference between those exemptions is personal, is that a parent says that they have a personal belief that does not allow them to vaccinate their children. And then religious is similar, but they're stating that they have a religious belief that does not allow them to vaccinate their child. For both of those, they are required per Washington state law to go have a conversation with their child's healthcare provider about the risks and benefits of vaccination. And then the provider signs off a form stating that that conversation happened.
Can I mention that, yeah. Just, I don't know when you're gonna get to this, but after we had our measles outbreak in 2019, there was a statute that was passed, actually two of our local representatives. It was bipartisan. Monica Stonier and Paul Harris, he's an orange, she's a D, actually sponsored a bill that removed another term for personal exemption. It's also philosophic exemption. It was removed for the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, but it still exists for all other required vaccines. I don't know whether you're going to get to that or not.
Not in that detail.
That happened in 2019. Yeah.
So that happened in 2019. You see that our exemptions for religious and personal exemptions have just crisscrossed there. And then just to touch on the other types of immunization exemptions. So medical exemptions are if they have a medical condition that makes it contraindicated for them to get vaccinated. Those can be temporary or permanent. If they're temporary, then there's a date set on those when they expire. Religious membership exemption, that is for folks who are part of a religious organization that does not allow any sort of medical care for their child at all or even for themselves. So if they don't see a healthcare provider at all, parents can just sign off on that form on their own and say that they have a religious membership exemption. And again, that remains fairly low in our community and across the state.
I'd say one other thing, I apologize, and you may be getting to it, but medical exemptions are really rare. There are very few medical exemptions.
Correct.
Yep. Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, next slide. So that was our school data. So I wanted to also share with you guys a little bit of the data from the Washington State Immunization Information System, which is a mouthful, so the registry, I will call it to make it easier to say. So our data from the registry. So this is data that the State Department of Health shares out every year. And you can see on here, this is for 19 to 35 month olds. And then we have what we call the 4313314 series, which I don't expect you guys to be able to rattle off like that. But what that is the 4-DTaP, 3-polio, 1-MMR, 3-HEP-B, 3-HIB, 1-Varicella, and 4 pneumococcal vaccines that these children should have received by the time they turn 19 months of age. So what we see on here is in 2019, we were at a high for series completion of 57.6%. And then by the end of 2024, we were down to 47.2%. These numbers do seem pretty low, and we do typically run a little bit lower than the state, but in part that is due to some data messiness again. So just to share with you, often the data in the IIS has some denominator inflation. And the reason for that is that all children are entered into the system when they're born in Washington State. So all those records get put in there. But patients aren't removed when they move out of state. The only way that would happen is if they continue to see a provider here in Washington State and their address got updated. But typically that doesn't happen. So kids just linger in the system. There's also some minor errors that are due to duplicate or erroneous records. I know I always can find a Mickey Mouse in there if I'm looking for a fake record to pull up, so clinics will use that and that data gets put in. But the state does work to clean up those records.
Can I just, just so they all understand, so all children when they're born or entered into the system, whenever they see a provider and get a immunization, the provider enters it into the system. So obviously if they see a provider in Oregon, it may not.
I'm getting there.
But I just want them to understand where this data comes from, because it's hard to get a grasp on it if you don't know how it's created in the first place. So this This is a different data system than the school system that she just showed you. That data gets entered when people enroll their kids in school. This is filled out by providers when they give shots and it goes into the system.
Yep. Let me know if I got that wrong.
No, nope, that's great, and you're queuing me up for my next thing. You guys are doing a great job.
It helps to have that at the beginning so they understand where it's coming. Yep. I'm sorry, so they know yep. where it's coming
no,
from.
No, you're good. So the next thing I wanted to talk about was just our enumerator. So where does that come from? As Alan said, providers in Washington State all enter data into the IIS system. It's not required that they enter the data into there. There's no law. Some other states do have laws that say that providers have to enter the data, but we do have really good provider compliance and participation in the program.
How do you know?
How do we know? Because most providers, they actually participate in a program called the Childhood Vaccine Program, where they get vaccines through the state. And as part of that program, they need to be entering data into the system to manage their inventory through that program. So most all providers do. We did have a lot of pharmacies that weren't participating, but through the COVID vaccine program, most pharmacies are now on board. So the data has just gotten a lot more robust. But with all of that said, we do have a little bit of numerator deflation or missing data in there because we are a border county again. So we do have kids that are seen over in Oregon, and those vaccines, our systems don't talk to the Oregon alert system, so those vaccines don't get entered. So we do see our numbers a little lower. So again, just explaining, when you see that 57.6%, yes, our numbers are low, but there are some factors that are, you know, decreasing that number. And what we are focused on and worried about mostly is the overall trend and what we're seeing. So next slide. So similar data, also from the IIS. This is for our 4 to 6 year olds. This is the 5-4-4-3-2-2-2-4 series. So again, we're looking at our DTaP, HIV, polio, Hep B, MMR, varicella, hepatitis A, and then pneumococcal vaccines. So in addition to what I just talked about with our data messiness, a little bit of the reason for the lower rates here is that the previous slide, all of the vaccines listed in that series children were due for before they hit that age group. With these vaccines, we've got the DTaP, polio, MMR, and varicella that kids are actually due for until they're 4 to 6 years old. So they're not actually overdue for those vaccines yet. We also see a little bit more of that data messiness because we're dealing with a little bit older kids. So especially that denominator inflation can happen as kids have had a couple more years to potentially move out of state. But what we see here again for our trends are 28.8% in 2019 and then 24.7% at the end of 2024 that we're concerned about it decreasing. You'll also see that green line on there, and that's our HIV vaccine. That one is messy just on its own because for HIV vaccine, this shows that they've gotten 4 doses of that vaccine, but depending on the presentation that they got, because there's different brands, they may only get 3 doses. And then if they're vaccinated late and on a catch-up schedule, they may not need the full 4 doses and are still considered up to date. So that's why that one is a little
Brianna,
bit more
can I just add something? Yeah. For those of you who don't know, varicella is chicken pox. Some of you may or may not know that. HIV is Haemophilus influenza B. It's a bacterial infection that those of us who are old enough to practice before that vaccine became available. It causes meningitis in kids and periorbital cellulitis, some nasty epiglottitis too, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, which is deadly. It's a really horrible infection. So we virtually eliminated that with the HIV vaccine, and varicella, we don't see much chicken pox, but we can talk about that as well, anyway.
Yes, just to be clear, that bottom line, that it looks black from here.
It's navy blue, but yeah, blackish.
Navy blue. That's the number of 4 to 6 year olds who have completed the whole 5-4 series.
Correct, yeah.
Is anyone else shocked by how freaking low this is?
Well, what she was saying, the MMR is indicated between 4 and 6 years of age. Okay. So a 4-year-old may not have gotten the MMR yet, and they're still considered up to date.
Okay.
The point, though, with that, though, is they're susceptible. I mean, one of the reasons we get vaccines to begin with is to protect not only ourselves, but people around us. So there's a large
susceptible population there. Some of them actually may have not gotten any vaccine at that age. Either they've gotten just one or zero.
Yeah.
Is that correct, Brianna? I'll make sure I'm saying this
right. That's totally correct. And again, what I want to focus on here is the overall trend. And you can see for the vaccines, when we take the HIV out of it, that we did have that peak around 2019, and then rates have been decreasing since the COVID pandemic.
But you're right, that is ridiculous.
It's ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. Yep.
Next slide here. So just looking at a little bit older kids. So again, just to remind you, now kids have had a little bit longer to move out of the state, so we have a little bit more of that denominator deflation. Same thing for this series, the 111 series, a little bit easier to remember. So we've got one Tdap, one HPV vaccine, and one meningococcal vaccine that these kids should have received. But again, they're all due at 11 to 12 years of age, so they're not overdue yet when we're looking at this data. But focusing on the trends, we were at 35.5% complete, and that has dropped to 25.1% complete following the COVID pandemic here. So, next slide.
Stupid.
I'm sorry.
It is. It's kind of just stupid.
Well, you know, I just want to mention one other thing about epiglottitis. As you're sitting here, just double check, it was Haemophilus influenza B. The epiglottis is a flap that sits over your airway. So if you've ever seen a kid with epiglottitis, it's frightening because they can't breathe and their eyes get really big as they're struggling to breathe. It's just a horrible, horrible thing to see, which we don't generally see anymore because we've got a vaccine for it. But the thing that we could actually start seeing that again.
We probably will, because we've seen everything else.
Scares the heck out of me.
Mm-hmm. We'll probably see polio again with what Kennedy is doing with it. I'm serious. Mm-hmm. I've never had a high blood pressure until we got in office. I'm serious.
Perfect. So I did want to move on to talk about what we've been doing as an immunization program to help address these rates a little bit. So next slide, please. So the first thing that we've done is that we restarted the Clark County Immunization Coalition. So we had a coalition prior to COVID pandemic starting, and then it kind of went by the wayside a little bit, and we have restarted that here. So our coalition includes members from Clark County Public Health staff, clinic staff, pharmacists, school nurses, pharmaceutical company representatives, and then interested community members that are able to join us as well. And we're co-chaired by a local physician here in Clark County. Next slide. So we restarted and relaunched in May of 2024. What we've been doing is hosting quarterly meetings. At these meetings, we're providing updates to our community partners on immunization-related topics. So usually things are timely, like in the fall, we'll cover COVID vaccines and flu vaccines and RSV vaccines, all of those respiratory season vaccines. So just timely updates for our membership. And then the meetings also provide an opportunity for networking, so connections can be made. I know through our meetings, school districts have made a lot of connections with our local clinics and been able to host back to school events and things like that. We also partnered with Within Reach, which hosts the Immunize Washington Coalition, which is statewide, and Washington State Department of Health and other partners to plan and host the Building Immunity Strengthening Community statewide conference this year in June. And our attendance at our meetings has grown from 13 to 25 attendees this year. And then you can see our mission on the slide here. Next slide. Additional projects include giving annual updates for our school nurse partners. So our school nurses are really an extension of public health. We tell them that every year because we appreciate them so much. And we want to be a resource for them. So we provide updates on anything that has changed with immunization reporting requirements or immunization requirements in general. And then we do these presentations in conjunction with our infectious disease program and our STI program to also provide robust updates. Additionally, I am our regional representative for the Immunization Quality Improvement for Providers program. So this is actually a federal program that trickles down to the local level. And what this program does is we work with local healthcare providers every year to identify and implement quality improvement projects to increase immunization rates within their clinics. So this involves a lot of just identifying, are there workflow issues where they're missing getting patients back in by doing reminder recall and having systems in place? Are there resources that they need from us that we can either create or give to them if they already exist? and providing them the resources that they need to have conversations with their patients around vaccines. Next slide. We also have started doing outreach to child care provider partners and prenatal care providers. So we've been providing quarterly newsletter updates to them. And in these newsletters, we'll include things like our back-to-school event flyers, where we promote any back-to-school immunization events that are coming up for easy access to vaccines. We put together some FAQ flyers to simplify the language around immunization requirements to help them have those conversations with parents. We also put together communication tools and then providing them with research articles and evidence summaries around immunizations and why they're important so they can better talk with their patients or with their child care attendees and their parents.
Is that information also available in other languages besides
yes.
English?
Yeah, we translate things generally into Spanish, Russian, Ukrainian, and Chukis are our four main languages that we try to hit. And next slide. So additionally, this past year, we worked on a media campaign. This campaign, we adapted previously created materials for Washington State Department of Health, but they had been focused on infants, and we wanted to focus on school-age children. So we adapted the imagery that was used and updated it to be Clark County specific. The campaign ran from September to October of 2024 and received 8 million impressions. The ads ran on social media, cable and digital TV, and on websites here locally. And we were focused on parents of school-age children with this campaign. We also worked on a market research project with them. And through this market research, we had key informant interviews conducted with both vaccine hesitant parents as well as providers in our community to gather more information on reasons for vaccine hesitancy. And we'll utilize that information to develop a tailored outreach program and materials and direct our future program planning that we're working on. Next slide. And then for direct outreach that continues to be ongoing as well is that we post routinely on social media around immunizations. These are just some of our most recent posts here, and you can see what we've been focusing on this summer is back to school immunizations, where parents can find resources to see if their child's up to date and where to get vaccinated, and then also discussing measles vaccination and the need for that in light of recent outbreaks across the state, or not state, but nation. Not Washington State yet, not Gumwood, so.
Brianna, I imagine probably, yeah. Do you have the ability to geolocate where problem areas are?
So we can get some data. The IIS does break data down that we can see it by zip code area, and we can target those, yeah. And then we also use what's called the Social Vulnerability Index and look at that. So areas that have a high need and have low access to healthcare. So we'll try to target those areas too with some of our messaging. If we do paid campaigns on social media, those can be targeted to specific zip codes. So the media campaign that we did, those were targeted to certain areas. We do have a harder time targeting certain demographics if they aren't broken out nicely for us, but we can target areas of the county geographically.
The other thing you can do is the state has a dashboard, and we get you the link. You can actually look at individual school buildings. You can look at immunization rates by school district, you can zero in on the building, on the school building, and look at immunization rates for each school.
Wow.
And believe it or not, you know, she's showing you the average here, but there are some schools in Clark County that have frighteningly low immunization rates.
Probably in my part of the county, more than part of the county.
Some of them, yeah, but not all of them, yeah. So there's just little pockets.
What about like homeschool and stuff like that?
Yeah, so if they're homeschooled, that's a little bit harder to track because they don't have anybody that they have to turn records into. The hybrid program, so if they are part of those programs like the Home Link and that sort of thing, then they do need to submit their records. So we do see a little bit of a glimpse into the homeschooling, but if they're 100% homeschooled, then yeah, we don't have a way to really track that or glean that.
Private schools are in, so the religious private schools, they're in the database as well. So you can click on them and see what their rates are.
So I'm glad that you're doing these outreach programs like through media, but like, does it work? Because the only reason I ask this is because The people that are anti-vax, also anti-fluoride, they're like anti-everything.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm talking to them, and it's like talking to a brick wall. I mean, it's like, my church says so-and-so that fluoride is, and they quote something, and I'm like, that's nice. You know, but, you know, it's fine, but it's just, I don't know, I feel like it, I have family from Spain, and they think we're insane. I mean, they think that we're really stupid, because it's like, they just kind of top down, you do not, like, there's no homeschooling. Like, there's no homeschooling in Spain, so everybody has to do it this way, there's one track, and everybody does it. So it just seems like this needs to be more of a, like, we can't be nice about it. We can't just be like, you know, it'd be really great if you vaccinate. You know, you kind of have to push them into it.
Yeah, but, yeah, and that's why we do see requirements for school entry. You know, we have the exemptions, unfortunately, I'll say in this room, right? But we do have that little bit of an out, but requirements do work. For people. It's also a multi-pronged approach, so we're not just doing the media campaign, but my work with healthcare providers to give them the tools and resources to have those conversations with parents. I did just see some research today in a newsletter article that it's like 15 to 17 times that people need to be presented with information before they might change their mind about something. So keeping up with the media campaigns, and we want them to go to that Vaccine Smart Washington and look through the data. You never know when that aha moment is going to happen and what, you know, is going to happen, that they have a friend that got sick, or, you know, they read something that made more sense to them than what they're hearing online and other sources. So it's keeping up with that messaging, which can be, yes, like banging your head against a brick wall, but you hope that it does work and that we make some headway or at least stop the backslide.
The point that Kurt made, I think, is 100% true. It's like you can hit somebody over the head 17 times, and they're still going to deny it. And and it's like, I don't understand how to talk to you now.
Yeah, and that does happen, unfortunately. We do also know from the data, though, that the group of folks that are really anti-vax and truly are not going to listen to anything is fairly small. And we've got a much larger group of parents that are just vaccine hesitant. And there is some, you know, some traction there that
so
we can
try to get the people in between,
yes.
So to speak.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And building those relationships, building that trust, and that's part of the market research that we did. That was one of our key takeaways there, was that you really need to build that trust and those relationships in other ways and just keep at it. We were surprised with the market research. We were specifically looking for people that were vaccine hesitant and didn't want to vaccinate, but even them, some of them were getting some vaccines, like they may have gotten the MMR vaccine because of the measles outbreak. So people will surprise you and things can change their minds. So. As much as, yes, it feels like banging my head against a brick wall some days, you have to stay motivated and keep at it.
How do you change the state letting the personal and religious exemptions? Because, I mean, I came from California, and that was absolutely no.
Yeah.
Medical or nothing.
Yeah. Yeah, so that, you know, is through the legislative process.
And is there hope for that?
Well, that's how we got, well, it was difficult enough, and we had this big measles outbreak here. And the only thing we were able to get through was removing the philosophic exemption for the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. So all the other vaccines that are required for school, you can still get a philosophic, you know, personal exemption. By the way, I don't know of any religion that says thou shalt not vaccinate. So. And when the philosophic exemption was eliminated,
they just
the religious exemption, people suddenly got religion and the number of religious exemptions went up.
Question, how can they don't vaccinate in the school itself?
A lot of it's due to staffing. So most schools are sharing a school nurse with multiple schools. And then we have been able to bring that back again through coalition and partnership. So last year, CMAR and Legacy both helped out at school districts, Vancouver School District and Evergreen School District, and did hold some on-site clinics after school. So that is coming back a little bit, and I hope that that will continue to grow.
The other question, I could be wrong, did the state have a 70% goal at one time, or that was kind of thought you needed at least that for in relation to herd immunity?
For measles, you need northward of 95%.
Yeah.
It seems like years ago they were trying to get 70%.
Yeah, and there's
we're well above 70% here, believe it or not. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say there's always the healthy people goal, healthy people 2030 is what we're working towards right now.
You also said, I think on your first or second slide, you showed the number of exemptions here in Clark County, and it was double what it is the state, statewide?
Yeah, and that's our kindergarten data. Again, the other data, when I was looking at that, it was just so messy. It looks like they've come down, but I don't think that they truly have.
Okay.
So pretty well across the board, we're about double.
I'm sorry, yeah, I just don't get it.
The kindergarten data is concerning, though, also because given the amount of misinformation that's increased over the last couple of years, having a kindergarten rate, immunization rate that's lower than the K through 12 rate, we have a new cohort of kids moving into school age, and if the kindergarten rate is lower than the older kids' rate, we're likely to see that those kids are going to become older kids, and that's...
It's a wrong trend, is what you're saying.
The trend is not good. So it's interesting to compare the kindergarten rate, and you can look at it by school district and school building as well, and compare that to the K through 12 rate. And the kindergarten rate, the last time I looked, was generally lower than the K through 12 rate. That's scary.
We see a lot of kids that come in, because it's one of the questions you ask is in the emergency department screening is, are they vaccinated? And there's a lot that are not.
I was fascinated by what Dr. Truong said, because I hadn't thought about the dentistry application of this before, except reading that about Camas and them being all bent on about that. But I do vaccine clinics. I have my own business, and I do vaccine clinics for animals. And I agree with Robert that there's a whole bunch of people in the middle that are vaccine hesitant that I've actually been able to turn. They come in, and they're saying, I just want the rabies because I got a ticket from animal control. I have to get this one. And I said, would you like to vaccinate your dog against parvo? Because that can kill them, and lepto can kill them, and that can kill you. You know, and I'm really nice about it, nicer than I'm being now. And I turn a lot of them, and they're just hesitant, and they just haven't had it explained to them right. But then there are others that come in that are saying, no, give me the damn rabies vaccine and let me go. And they have their MAGA hats on, and out they go. And I'm never going
to
turn
them. Look what you just pointed out to. They got a ticket because they got, it's like,
yes.
So this is what just blows my mind. It's like, why are we passively letting
this happen? Why is there not some repercussions for these decisions that are putting so many people, especially children, at risk?
Right, and I get that.
They do it. Animal control does it. These are big tickets.
And I get that it can be perceived as fascist, but it's like at some point, like, you got to weigh the public good versus your own individual liberty, and it's like, well, sorry, you got to get the vaccine.
I don't get it.
So I think some of the struggles around this are vaccine is one treatment we give to people who are healthy. Most of the time you're getting a treatment is because you're sick, you have some sort of illness. So vaccine is given to people who are otherwise feeling well. The other issue is I think that either people are unaware and don't understand that getting the vaccine for themselves helps protect other people around them. Either they don't understand that, or they don't, in some cases, they may not care about that. But those are some of the issues that you need to deal with in terms of, or addressing them. And a lot of them just don't understand that. They don't understand the value of, you know, we get vaccinated because we all interact with each other and we want to protect other people.
I had a question on adults. Is there information that, you know, like I had shots when I was a kid, but I didn't really haven't had any. Is there some information on what I should be getting, or?
Yeah, there's information on CDC's website. There's a whole adult immunization schedule that you can review. As far as like the registry, having data in there, that's really hit or miss for adults. So you'd have to hunt down those records. But yes, there are schedules out there for adults and what you should be getting, both by your age, but then also by risk factor and health risk factors as well, is typically more important for adults.
Also, there's a lot of misinformation about how serious these illnesses are. So, I mean, somebody, I think, even on, was it on our social media site, talked about the Brady Bunch, and there was a measles outbreak, and it was, you know, a sitcom, and nobody got, you know, the Brady Bunch had it. It was, you know, like before the measles vaccine, 500, mostly children died every year in the United States, and there were 50,000 hospitalizations. But they think that measles is some sort of benign disease. But that's the kind of stuff we see on our social media. I think that was on our
Yeah, that was just on one of our recent posts.
If you should take a look if you really want to be in. And actually, what you guys should do,
there's a 10 to Board of Health meeting. So at our Board of Health meetings, people come and I don't know if you watch them at all, but we have some really crazy stuff that's presented there. It'd be great if we had.
We have the one lady that came here with the
book. With the book?
Her name is Wendy Grusich, and she hosts my city council meetings all the time. We just talked about fluoride last night, and thank God our city council decided by a 5-2 vote that they weren't going to take fluoride out of the water. And I'm shocked it was 5-2. Why wasn't it 7-0? It's an easy decision. We had Dennis, like Kurt here, stand in front of us and say, fluoride, you should take it out of the water.
The same people who are talking about vaccines are also talking about crazy stuff about fluoride.
They're the ones that go, well, you know what, I've done the research. It's like, no, what you've done is gone online, you Googled something, and then you think that's research. That is not research. That is just some average person who was just saying all kinds of, forgive me, shit online, and like everybody swallows it up like it's, oh my God, and I'm sorry.
That's like Wikipedia, anybody could type in.
So it's good news that Camas, both Camas and City of Vancouver are continuing to fluoridate their water.
So is Battleground too, so there you go.
Yeah. Brian, I have a question. I don't know if there's a way that you'll be able to measure this or if you have already. Have you noticed any increase in the vaccine hesitancy percentage with that person in the federal government creating all this misinformation? Have you noticed anything and what?
I don't have a good way to like measure vaccine hesitancy per se, and that has been so recent that we really won't have data for like another year here.
Most of the stuff just hit the fan recently,
But I do expect that we'll start seeing that in the IIS data next year or the year after. And then when I do work with clinics, I run, you know, their immunization rates for that IQIP process that we do and share their individual rates with them. So we can see that a little bit sooner, just on the clinic level, that I can share with them where they're at as well.
One thing that might give you some comfort is that even though the CDC and the feds decided to stop recommending COVID-19 vaccinations for children and pregnant women, which is crazy. Considering in Washington State, we in collaboration with the State Department of Health, are continuing to recommend vaccines, a COVID-19 vaccine for anybody 6 months of age and older, as well as pregnant women. So that the problem is, you know, the other concerns we have about this stuff is that I'm gonna go there and mention it because you guys are interested in policy. One of the concerns we had is actually the state. ASTA, which is the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials. They're the state health department directors across the country. It's their national organization. They put out a notice that that we need to take a look at state statutes and state code, because there may be some implications, you know, that they changed. You've been following the information about the ACIP, the Committee on Immunization Practices, that they just fired everybody. And so we took a look. I'm working with my colleagues around the state. We took a look at the Washington State statutes and administrative code. And lo and behold, the laws themselves refer to ACIP recommendations. And that's a concern I have about the state law that includes vaccination requirements in schools, cites the ACIP guidelines and the ACIP recommendations.
And that is non-existent now.
Well, or it's changing, and so we are actually looking at, and this is something for FAC to be aware of, as well as our Board of Health to be aware of, that we may need to get engaged with the legislature and look at removing some of that language from RCWs, the state statutes and administrative code. So we're actually having a meeting, health officers around the state are having a meeting tomorrow to and that's on our agenda, actually, to talk about. I'm the chair of that group, so we'll be meeting to talk about that. But that's kind of, I thought it was bad enough to begin with in terms of not being able to trust the ACIP, but now I realize that there could be an implication for our ability to manage outbreaks in Clark County, so.
That's frightening.
It is pretty, well,
Yeah, these are the ACIP. I mean, I could give you the list of statutes and the WAC where ACIP is mentioned. So you've seen that as well, right?
Yeah, I had looked at the school immunization WAC, and it looked like they had put in that it was the ACIP 2024. I don't know that they did that intentionally, but I'm hoping that that will save us, that it's the ACIP 2024 recommendations. Let me know how your meeting turns out.
That's the WAC, yeah.
Yeah, and then for the child care, it had actually listed out the vaccines that children are required to have, but didn't like say how many doses and stuff, so that one might be a little bit more ambiguous. But yes, we'll see how everything plays out.
Am I ruining everybody's evening? Normally, you know, public health is a state function. It's not mentioned in the Constitution. The only thing health isn't, the only way the feds get involved is funding, which you've heard about, and the ability to regulate interstate commerce. Otherwise, it's all based, our ability to do public health work was based on state law and state statute. This is just a wake-up call to me that even given that the state statute refers to a federal body, it could have an implication for us. So anyway, we can change that though, maybe.
Yeah, hopefully. Well, thank you all. Any other questions before I head out?
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you all.
Thanks, Brianna. Thank you. We get to do it again tomorrow morning.
I know.
Good practice. All right, well, great conversation, and this might lead into one we're going to have a little bit later, so I'm glad to hear this conversation. So. But next on the agenda is Jeff to update us on some budget information.
I don't have a lot on budget, but just quickly off of that, this morning I actually saw a social media post where someone was asking, their children were starting school this fall, and they were asking for a doctor locally who could sign exemptions for not an arm and a leg. They referred it to someone in Ballarat, charging us $50, I believe.
I've seen him.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's something that could be reported to the medical commission. So if somebody is signing exemptions inappropriately and charging for that, that's a licensing issue. So.
Get on that, doc.
Well, I don't know anybody can report them to the medical commission, so. You're aware of that, huh?
Well, I am. Yeah, I'm aware of a few physicians in our community, mostly naturopaths, that will just sign them. For a fee, basically.
So naturopaths can sign exemption forms. Yeah. I just learned something right there.
Yeah. All right.
How about chiropractors? Can they do that?
No.
God.
They go on a cry, but yeah, they can. All right. Well, thank you all. And then I'll let Jeff do his special budget update.
So right now, our draft budget, we have eliminated 8 vacant positions. We are not quite balanced. We've had some bad news with the Me Too grievance. Some good news, the employer portion of PERS, which is our pension system, the employer contribution went down quite a bit. That was some good news. But we lost, I'm not sure if I've talked about this before, the solid waste fund was with public health since 2017. And it's been transitioned to Public Works. That's costing us around $400,000 a year between indirects and space rent. Well, we're saving a little more than that in the pension. So there's bad news one day, good news the next. But we've eliminated, right now we've got 8 vacant positions eliminated. We're not quite balanced. Tomorrow, I've got the work session after Board of Health, with the Board of Health, regarding our environmental public health fees, fee scenarios. I presented these last month at FAC. We've since met with the on-site septic technical advisory committee, as well as the drinking water technical advisory committee, and the food safety group. What are they, TAC also, technical advisory committee. Surprise, when I present 3 scenarios, the third of which is subsidized by general fund and keeps the fees lower, there's not support against that. So. Tomorrow we'll be presenting to the Board of Health, and that's the scenario that's gotten support across the board. So scenario 1, if you remember from last month, was maintaining current policy, and the fees were going up like 50.5%. Scenario 2 moved to full cost recovery in all programs, and that was around a 17.7% increase in fees. And then scenario three is where we use our fund balance to mitigate any individual fee from going up more than 5%. That has a collective 3.8% adjustment to fees across the board. So that's what we're presenting tomorrow. It did get support from all the TACs. The individual Board of Health members were supportive of that when I had one of the ones last month. I think that's going to be breeze tomorrow. I did have to move. So that after the work session, we then have to bring an ordinance forward, which adjusts county code. And I used the feedback from the work session to draft an ordinance. I'm doing that in August instead of September. Normally I do it in September. I messed up my schedule, so I'm doing it at the Board of Health public hearing at the end of August. So we're very close to a balanced budget for 2026. Looking forward, 2027, we lose the residual from the American Rescue Plan Act, or ARPA, as some of you know it. That's around $390,000 a year for system support. So we'll have the standard budget challenge, which is our revenues are flat and our expenses go up. We'll have that standard hole, and then we're adding on top of it the $390,000 loss of ARPA. So it'll be a not great budget again, but this budget went from catastrophic to be honest, eliminating 8 vacant positions is somewhat manageable, actually. I thought it would be far worse. The governor's first, his budget, Governor Ferguson's budget, we would have lost $1.8 million in FPHS revenue. We ended up losing $175,000. So it's $1.6 million better than it was looking like it was going to be. So it's odd for me to say it's a manageable budget when we're eliminating 8 positions and we're not quite done. But it could have been far, far worse. I was thinking it was going to be far worse. Right now, this does not have any significant impact to our federal funding. That's another obvious element we need to watch. Actually, we got a $108,000 increase to one of our federal preparedness grants, which was a surprise. We're just monitoring federal budgets. We're monitoring federal spending. It's looking, we're in the home stretch. The other thing I did want to talk about, I've engaged with my financial operations manager who reports to me. We're going to come together and work on an educational program for FAC for the fall, not in the heat of budget season where I've got little time and I can't share everything. We haven't communicated everything yet, but we're going to actually walk through our budget process a little bit this winter, maybe even January before the next budget season. That way there's a little bit more understanding. I feel bad you guys are tasked with advising the Board of Health on our budget and our fees. It's very difficult for us to explain and have enough of a conversation where you fully understand what they're saying. That sounds great. So we're going to try to roll out a series, or at least one session where we can talk about how the budget really works, not in the heat of battle.
They used to.
I'm thinking we used to have a, so I've got a senior over here, I think FAC used to have a budget.
We do, and what I'm hoping is we're going to do this educational thing, hopefully, in one FAC meeting, and that might, after hearing some of that and learning a little bit more about it, we might get a few more people who want to join the budget subcommittee. So I'm hoping that might work. But the full FAC is tasked with, as a body, FAC is tasked with advising on budget and fees, and I want to make sure that I do what I can with the whole FAC first. So I have been here since 1998. I've been through a few budgets. I've seen us get decimated, and I've seen us grow at such a rapid pace that it's ridiculous. Any questions on our budget, on anything that I've presented?
Thank you, Jeff. Our next topic is around the Board of Health retreat that is set up for July 31st. As you know, we had one retreat of a longer period of time that talked about our relationship with the Board of Health. And I know there's been a request from both sides to try to enhance our partnership with them and having better communication between the two entities. And so on the 31st of July, our next one is scheduled. What we want to talk about tonight is the agenda for that particular meeting. It gives us an opportunity to communicate with the Board of Health face-to-face, and we're an advisory council to the Board of Health and to public health. And so this gives us an opportunity to have some impact or some conversations with them about different things that we have heard or talked about here in our council meetings. And so Emily is going to kind of talk about how we might have, what our agenda might be for this next meeting and how you might participate. So,
yeah, I think we do a lot of listening to the public health in action, and we sometimes have conversations about it, but it's a really good opportunity at these meetings for us to have conversations that kind of actually give feedback and really fulfill our role. So whether that be asking questions about, I mean, for us to ask questions about how we can bring back that information into our community, but then also thinking through what we can ask about and what we can ask for hearing that. And so, you know, thinking back over the public health in action presentations that we've heard, one that I thought of was the benthic mats. It was kind of wild that I had been at Cottonwood Beach with my daughter the week prior, or the day prior or something, and I have pictures of her standing next to these like big green sludgy things, and I'm going, huh, okay, we're not gonna touch that because I've never seen that before, and this is new, I know this river. And you know, that opportunity for us to say, hey, you know, what can be done about this so that becomes a known thing? How can we increase communication to Clark County, and then how can we also bring more information back into our own communities? So, you know, I'm part of some river groups, I'm part of some other things, I'm part of some preschool groups, we're all bringing our kids out. And I have concerns that, apart from the fact that I follow the Clark County Public Health Facebook page, I haven't heard anything else about that. And I think about other parents with children. This is kind of a new thing on our rivers that is able to make our kids sick and able to make our animals sick. And so just how that's being communicated and stuff like that. So, and I think this is also just an opportunity for us to think through, you know, what we want to talk about and what we want to recommend, and increasing conversation.
And I think it gives us an opportunity. We've had presentations on immunizations tonight, which the Board of Health is going to get tomorrow. We just had the climate mapping project, and then the algae bloom. And so these presentations are given to the Board of Health, and we see them as well. And so it's an opportunity for us to maybe give our perceptions of that information and what effect that might have with the groups that we work with or we're part of. Or what is their take on, what are they going to do with this information? How does that affect things that they talk about or policies that they may make? The one that resonated with me was the climate mapping project, and about how does that affect like zoning and planning and and we're cutting down trees and building apartments and houses, and so how do we try to avoid having those heat zones, and does that resonate with them and any kinds of policies or things that they think about? So and then the conversation we just had now about all the immunizations and what can we do about that. And so I think that this particular meeting is a good time for us to have those open conversations about how we feel about how it affects and impacts our community, and then also having a conversation back and forth about how they feel about that information. We're wanting to make sure that you guys know that this is happening as an opportunity just for the Public Health Advisory Council and the Board of Health to meet and have those conversations. It will be face-to-face and virtual, but we'd like to encourage you to come face-to-face, because I think that gives a more impactful kind of conversation versus trying to do it over virtual, but also understanding that that's not always possible for everyone. But it's easier to have that conversation when it's face-to-face. So I guess I'd like to open it up to see how you feel about that, what the conversations might be, questions you have about how that might operate.
Can I add one thing?
You bet.
So all this is in the context of, you know, the board of health is, our county council is looking at whether they should change the structure of the board of health and add non-elected members to their board of health versus having a FAC. They could actually do both. They can keep the FAC and add non-electeds to the board of health, or they can just add non-electeds to the board of health and eliminate FAC. So I think we've shared that with you before, and they're having that, they've been having that conversation now. Their interest is making sure that they have community input and wanting community input in terms of their deliberations about policy as well as budget and funding and fees and things like that. That's why we've been bringing this stuff to you. But I have a bias, maybe I shouldn't share it. I think we get more community input potentially with FAC than having a few non-elected members on the Board of Health. But other people think about that differently. And we're going to talk about the Board of Health training this fall after we're done with this conversation.
The conversation about the models, that training for them is going to come up here in August, and then the September Board of Health retreat with us, that will be the topic. So we kind of thought that this one in July might be a good time to have this open conversation to kind of show them how there's a two-way conversation and how we can have that happen without them having to have just the non-electives and having input in a different way. So
they're going to get the same training. Those of you remember when Wasafo Jamie Bowden came in and spoke to you, it was virtual. She's going to do the same thing for the Board of Health. And I think it's going to be...
It has been postponed.
It's postponed to... it'll be early September. Yeah. Okay.
But before the September 18th.
Yeah, we hope.
Okay. All right.
So we're driving the agenda for this retreat then, or they are, or the combination?
Both. A combination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it'll be in about... We're proposing that it be about 90 minutes, that the original retreats were set for 3 hours, and that's a long commitment for this kind of a conversation. So we're gonna propose that it be about 90 minutes, and hopefully that'll make it easier for you to come physically and be part of that conversation.
Feedback I've gotten from people just being a part of that is that they don't really feel like there's kind of a significant role that we play and that our voice is heard by the board, and so this is ideally the opportunity where you can just have that really direct conversation and say, hey, here's what my concerns were about vaccines, and you know, what can we implement, and what can we do, and what power do we have, and then also what our priorities are. In regard to the model being different, the reason I'm really in favor of FAC is because we have such an intentional breakdown of our community with someone from social services and someone from education and community members that are brought in such a way that we know that we're getting kind of a good cross-section. And you're all participating in this because you have ideas about this and you want to share that. And so this is just a really good opportunity to do that, that I'm hoping fulfills kind of what's been feeling like it was missing.
But that conversation will happen.
But, you know, we'll prove at this next one that we can have those conversations back and forth and let our preferences be known. And
I would hope there would be better attendance by FAC at this than there was last time. There was only about four of us.
I was there. It was probably only six.
Yeah. And I thought that didn't help us.
Were you there?
No,
Ashley was there.
Yeah. For the last one?
Yeah, it was in March.
Person?
Yeah. It was not the last in-person meeting, but it was the retreat that we did.
The retreat. Oh, yeah, you weren't the last one.
Is it middle of the day?
It was the morning through the afternoon.
It was a long day.
It was long, yeah.
We understand a lot of you have other day jobs.
It was very long. It started in the morning and went past lunch.
Yeah. And that's why we're proposing this one to just be about 90 minutes so that it can just be a conversation and it doesn't need, and more people can participate that way.
I would say that helps.
So to clarify, the next one is scheduled to take place on July 31st. Technically, it's supposed to go from 9 to noon, but we're saying that maybe we should only have it go from 9 to 10:30. And then the next one would take place September 18th, and I can put this in the minutes so you guys have the dates. And that one would also go from 9 to noon. We realized the last one was a little bit too long, and we ended early
anyway, so we figured 9 to noon would be the perfect time. And also, we are the ones creating the agenda.
Right now.
For the one on the 31st, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Correct. At this point, yes, we're creating agendas for all of them.
Just by we, you're referring to FAC.
FAC.
Okay.
Yeah,
I want to make sure not us.
Not us.
But the conversation that the executive committee had is that that's why we wanted to have this conversation tonight, is about the 3 or 4 topics that we've had presentations on, and I think Mallory has sent out things that you could review if you needed to be reminded about what was discussed, is to kind of either talk out or think about ahead about what your comments would be about the impact in the community, or what questions you have for Board of Health about what their response is to the presentations, or what policies they think they might affect.
I think it'll give us a good picture too of what policies they can affect if we're having these conversations with them, because I don't always know.
Yeah, and it could be just questions that we pose to them as well.
Yeah, I think that would be my biggest question. I mean, like, yeah, we hear a presentation, but what can Board of Health do? Like, if we say the personal exemption is ridiculous, we should get rid of that. I mean.
Well, you asked a good question about, you know, what can we do legislatively to change that?
Yeah.
You know, do they have interest in changing that legislative? I think that would be a good question for them, and to kind of see what their response is.
They have relationships with the delegation, and they have a lobbyist, and boards of health have influence in Washington State. When we did a prenatal care, because we're concerned about prenatal care, we did a summit. You were there, right? Mm-hmm. Were you there, or you heard about it? The legislative delegation was there, as well as a couple of members of our Board of Health. So,
could we get information like, or the Washington Association of Counties or the Public Health? They may have some, what they're doing, some ideas that we can expand upon.
Well, our council is members of WASAC, and so they have connections there. We do through our State Association of Local Public Health Officials for WASAC affiliates, so there's a relationship.
I was just wondering if they had any goals and stuff that...
WASAC itself?
Yeah.
Is that what you're asking?
I think he's asking about pledge priorities for WASAC.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
they have a legislative priority every year, right, that they discuss.
And our association...
WASAC level and our association.
But our association is an affiliate of WASAC, so it would be, we work together.
I was just thinking ideas for drilling meeting committee.
Mm-hmm. And I would think, you know, coming from FEC and Board of Health for the county with some of the lowest immunization rates in the state, for us to say, help us change it, I think that would mean a lot. And I think that's part of what our role is, you know, because if the Washington legislature's looking across the board and going, well, Clark County probably wants to be like that. They like their ability to.
Do we have records from other counties and what they're doing?
For
organization.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm just saying, because compared to if the average is 5% and we're at 10%,
right,
we have a problem. I think for them to hear that from us, I think that would be meaningful, because, you know, most of the opposition that they would get in the legislature, like, they would expect most of the opposition to be from the counties with higher rates of kids not being immunized. So hearing from us, I think, would be really significant. Our voice could be powerful there. And this is that opportunity.
So now, kind of one question that the board's looking at is, should they keep the current model of the FAC advisory, or should they just put 2 or 3 people on the Board of Health to represent the community?
It would actually be 5 people, because there has to be at least an equal number of non-electives. So they could do that. They could appoint 5 people to the Board of Health, to the council. Well, not to the council, I'm sorry. They wouldn't be members of the council. They'd be members of the Board of Health.
And they could do that and also keep that.
We check with our
attorney, and they said that was possible, but I'm not, they could keep both. They may decide, it'd be up to them.
Why haven't they already decided when, are they just looking for input on the best way to proceed?
What happened was, when that statute was created a few years ago, they created an exemption for, so the statute, the governor dropped this bill. The idea was to take the politics out of public health. You can judge how all that happened. And because what happened is some of the ideologic boards appointed non-electeds that fit their ideology. You know, it differed across the state.
Right.
But passed this bill that basically said county boards of health, in the county structure, there are health districts around the state, but counties that had the county structure of a board of health had to have an equal number of elected officials and at least one tribal member on their board of health. With an exception, if they had a community health advisory board or a FAC prior to January 1st, 2021, they wouldn't have to do that. They could keep that structure, and the FAC had to meet the definition of what was called a community health advisory board. When they drafted that statute, they actually used the FAC bylaws. FAC has been around since 2003. I think Mark is a charter member. They used our bylaws in creating that statute, so FAC definitely meets those definitions. So the board, our council, has never added any non-electeds to it. They went along with that. Last year, they went to this training that is coming up again in October. WSALFO, our State Association of Local Public Health Officials, has put on a training for Board of Health members on local boards of health, and they have attorneys come and explain everything, you know, do training for them. When they first did that, they've been doing it for a few years. When they first did that, a number of FAC members attended. I don't think anybody here, but you know, Elma was there. She's not here tonight. Marla was there, and I'm trying to remember.
There's one other
member attended it, and it was really great. None of our electeds attended that one. Last year, two of our electeds went. Council Chair Marshall and Councilor Young went to it. And last year, no FAC members attended. So I hope that some of you attend this year. We'll talk about that in a little bit, because Councilor Young is going again this year. Apparently, most of the attendees last year were people who are non-elected members of the Board of Health. The year that Elma went and Marla went, there were a lot of FAC folks there, and not many. This last time, when Councilor Young and Councilor Marshall went, there were a lot of non-elected members of the Boards of Health that went, and they were like really excited about that structure. So that was the scenario that our councilors were in. Councilor Young came back and wanted to revisit, after that experience, wanted to revisit the FAC, that structure that we have here, and look at having an alternative. And so that's how we got to this discussion going on.
That answered my unspoken question, was what prompted this, right, to come up now again. So.
And there are benefits to having that other, I mean, sure. I'm not, you know, I have my own little bias here. I like this because we've got 21 members from a variety of backgrounds and disciplines that five members aren't going to give you. And also, some of you are coming from represented sectors as well. So it's not just somebody picking somebody who meets their political. And yeah, I mean, and it depends on who's the electeds, because that can change too. And they can pick whoever they want to be their non-elected. So I'm blabbering too much. But.
So that'll be the major conversation for the September 18th meeting. Because hopefully they will have the training.
So Jamie Bowden, who came and spoke to you guys, is going to be coming and speaking. They want to hear an independent voice about, they've heard enough from me already, probably.
So comments or questions about the one on the 31st, and do many of you think you can attend?
I'll try.
As long as nothing's burning.
Good, I hope nothing's burning.
I'll try.
Okay.
It's on my calendar. I attended the last one.
Right. I'll be there. Emily will be there. Lori will be there. I'm sure. So.
I'll try to be there.
Okay, well, I'm sure there'll be a notice that'll come out. How do we proceed with the recommendation for the time?
I will reach out to Michelle tomorrow.
Michelle Fanning, yeah.
Because I think I saw many of you say it was helpful to have it just for 90 minutes. I mean, if you can only come for an hour, that's fine too. We'd like to hear your voices and see your faces.
And for those that can't or don't know if they will be, this is also an opportunity to express, you know, what your thoughts were on those last three or four presentations, and then we can bring that up as well.
Well, and it's also virtual, so, you know, if you wanted to chime in or see it.
Yeah, I would
easier to have a conversation face-to-face, but.
I think having a conversation with them about your takeaway from Public Health in Action would be any kind of ideas you have for them. Because the way it's supposed to work is the way the statute actually changed your role as well. And provide you're supposed to be providing policy input to them as well as recommendations on budget. So
this is our opportunity to even just what your reactions are to the presentation. Many of you had great reactions to the immunization presentation tonight. So and that was great. I was like, okay, can we do that again on the 31st? but you know, what are your impressions? What questions do you have about what they're going to do with that information, or did they just like? Nice to know and move on to the next point of business.
And you could bring up other things that you've experienced and other, you know, and you've heard a lot of stuff and a lot of your backgrounds. We talked, mentioned fluoride really briefly, but there's other, having a dentist being able to provide input is not, I don't know that there are any other dentists in the non-elected models around the state that are on boards of health, or veterinarian for that matter.
Doc, you bring up a good point. So I came to these prior to COVID, representing emergency management, and I know that we would often have presentations from public health staff that were just like the ones we've had. They were very interesting, they were engaging, and the unspoken question was, how does what you've seen here impact me as your emergency manager?
Absolutely.
One of the things that happened before COVID is sometimes FACT members, because I remember there was a really great one from the veterinarian on the time. There was some pet disease that was going around that the veterinarian on the FACT at the time did a really great presentation on what that disease really was, how it spread, how it didn't, and it was a great presentation. And it was a FACT member providing that input, not only to this body, but by extension to the Board of Health. And I think that that would be something that would also advocate for the benefit of a larger, more diverse group, is the opportunity for the subject matter expertise of this body to, when time allows, messaging allows.
That might have been left, though, I think, because we had some lakes, some of the artificial, you remember that?
Yeah.
We had some artificial lakes where people, I think you can learn how to water ski and stuff in them, and it was lepto, which there was a pet that was affected, but it can affect humans.
It was a
zoonotic illness.
Great presentation, and what was impactful was hearing it from a veterinarian, an animal health provider.
It gives it a little more credibility than because it starts in animals.
So you guys should feel free to talk about areas that you know. But by the way, for the at-large folks, your lived experience is also really important here as well. And you know, as a youth representative, your experience as a youth in Clark County is very
right. It's just a little hard when everybody has like a specific field, and I don't know when to put my input. But it's also pretty interesting hearing how it kind of all interconnects.
See, we had your predecessor prior to COVID, a long time ago, actually did a very impactful presentation on what her concerns were as an 18-year-old young woman about to enter her senior year in high school.
Yeah, I have a lot of concerns. It's just kind of hard when to like put my input, because I'm a very introverted person, but I wanted to get more involved in FACT this year, especially just because a lot of concerns with like nicotine, a lot of like drug rises, especially within my like range like age range. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of 15-year-olds I see already smoking or vaping. That's just kind of concerning. Or like doing marijuana, which is like you're not cognitively developed yet to be taking those kind of drugs. It's kind of, I don't know how to put those concerns out.
Well, the fact that those are your concerns, though, helps inform what we can do to help message that, to help support other agencies that are advocating that. Because if those are the things that are concerning you today, those are the challenges you're going to face tomorrow.
Yeah, I can also see that. I also see like the disconnect, like how they're representing their media outlet. I was like, oh, that'd be very interesting considering like a lot. My age group is also like on different platforms, not just like Facebook. I think like reaching out to those platforms are really good, especially considering a lot of them like are on social media, like TikTok, Instagram, things like that. So transferring that information there. And then, I don't know, I won't say that. Like my generation is very, like, I guess, woke, but I say they're more progressive in a sense. So a lot of them, like, I teach my parents about vaccines and what they were concerned about. Like, they're from Mexico, so they're not very, like, anti-vax, but very, like, just conservative about it. And, like, when I come here and I tell them, like, or relay that information, it just, like, broadens their perspective a lot. So I think, like, just transferring those different things can be beneficial as well.
And I think that's helpful at the meeting on the 31st for you to show, to tell about your perspective as a youth and what the concerns are and the, how some of the things in the community you could reach the youth in just what you said, you know.
Right. I do want to get more involved this like coming year, so that's
really we need to hear your voice.
I'm a little shy. I think, like, I don't know when to perspective, especially when I have like questions. So I was like, oh, well, I don't know.
We can turn you on to the Healthy Youth Survey, so you're probably familiar with it already.
Well, just based on the way you're speaking, I think you could be a very strong messenger on many platforms. Yeah. I think you're very valuable.
Oh, thank you.
I have just a comment. And forgive my ignorance because I'm still new here. Does this group have a document somewhere of a set of norms of how exactly you will advise Board of Health? Does that exist? So that might be something that would be worthwhile.
So there's bylaws and there's also description of fact and what its role is on our website. Which is
how is that done in action?
Mark could answer that as well as maybe some of the others, but I think from my perception, historically it's been through, like, if we have something we want to propose, it's a letter that's sent from us.
Which is so, or
from health department staff.
This might be an opportunity, assuming that fact continues, for the group to kind of decide how will you communicate about what topics and how often. So at the moment we have a July meeting and a September meeting. Is that enough to talk about? Is that enough? You know, and one possible way to approach the agenda might be that whoever's planning to come to attend in July, perhaps you bring forward your top three or top five concerns and talk about it to the group rather than kind of 90 minutes and stare at each other and nobody knows
let's
who to say
a
what
conversation.
To say. I don't
recall the last time we put a memo together.
It would be useful to define about what topics exactly, how often and when, how you would advise them, how you want to advise them, how they want to be advised. It may be helpful to draft something. Or
I think the meetings have been set quarterly for a while, so there might be a few more past September that have been planned. But I think that's a great idea, especially for this July one, if we come with our top three kind of concerns or questions or comments that we want to make is a good start. Because I think along the lines of what you're saying is we want to try to change that way that we communicate with the Board of Health and try to show them that we have a lot of interest in what moves forward in our community and let them know how it impacts our different sectors as well. So they may, you know, I'm not trying to say they don't understand how we communicate with our sectors, but they may not.
Mm-hmm. Did I hear that we're going to have Mallory send out just kind of past presentations that we've received, just because I try to remember off the top of my head all of them?
Yeah, I sent them out with the agenda, but I can send them out again with the minutes.
Send them out with a notice of the meeting to the date and
yes.
And I'd like to add, I'm sure you all are probably aware of this, but I'd like to voice it. Having your voice as a member of FAC in the community as in place of public health staff saying something, you know, and I'm kind of being facetious, but I heard someone over there say, this is so stupid.
Oh, man.
She can't say that.
We don't totally agree, but if we say it from public health, I mean, especially after the pandemic, a lot of the public just doesn't trust government at all. If it's a government employee, a government agency, or whatever, but you know, you represent entities or agencies of this community, and so your voice will carry a lot more weight.
I am government employee too, sister.
Yeah, I'm not advocating for you to go say it's stupid, but I'm just saying that you can help with this. So like when we do outreach events or we go to a specific targeted population, targeted is not a good word either, yeah, but focused population, to try to provide education and advocacy for you to attend with us or have someone from your entity attend with us and have that personal voice, I think would be very helpful too.
My kids made the cake with my help, because they're three, from the end of Lilo and Stitch yesterday, and it's like supposed to be the size of the oven, and Stitch pulls it out, and we're like, who do we feed this cake to? And so I rounded up the neighbors, and they've got cousins staying with them, so there's like 11 kids and 20 adults or whatever, and I went on about public health budgeting, and I was like so excited. And these like 20 people are listening to me explain like, oh yeah, most things are like priced this way, and so like the fee that you're paying is very closely related to the actual cost that they figured out of that thing. So you know, there's really no reason to be like, oh, the government's just taking the money for these things. Like it's very well coordinated, and was explaining greater good funding and it was like 20 people, and they were like, wow, it's really nice to know that like our public health department like cares about that. I didn't know any of this was funded, and I don't know how that happened.
Thank you.
Yeah, and that, but like those opportunities, I mean, that's why we're part of this is, you know, even me who doesn't have any job at all at the moment, you know, to bring that information back into our community, and that increases trust in this, you know, neighborhood and group that is maybe a little less trusting of government, to be able to have that conversation and go, oh, I didn't even know how this worked at all.
The Board of Health is also really looking to get input. They really want to hear from the community. Aside from the crazy people who show up.
Which is why FAC is so important, because otherwise all the Board of Health hears is those people who show up and make public comments.
Yeah. And if you want to really know what they are like, watch the Board of Health tomorrow.
Yeah.
With the immunizations presentation.
Well, now one of them came here to one of our meetings.
I just expect tomorrow to be crazy.
Really?
She was the immunizations.
Yeah.
Well, she took 2 or 3 minutes just saying who she was, and then she didn't say anything. I was like, okay.
She's the one who does the most written public comments. So you can go on to our website, park.y.gov, go to council meetings and elect, go down to the Board of Health. You can see the submitted public comments. It'll be hundreds of pages, literally hundreds of pages. A lot of references to YouTube videos and stuff. RFK's in there, RFK Jr.'s in there as well, but it goes on and on. There's a lot of fluoride's a poison stuff there. You'll get that, it'll raise your blood pressure. On and on.
Her words are about, huh?
It's all their research.
She comes to all kinds of meetings. I know exactly what she wants.
Well, some places it's a naturally occurring element.
Yeah. Like
what's that?
Fluoride, yeah. In some places a naturally occurring
element. So is aluminum, for that matter. Yeah, it's been used as an adjuvant in vaccines, and you actually get less aluminum as an adjuvant in vaccines than you get from your regular diet.
Yeah.
And it's in the main, one of the main components of the Earth's crust. But what do they care? You know, I mean, it's like.
What I thought was funny is that she ripped out a textbook for like 1989.
Oh,
and it was like referencing COVID. I was like, that's not possible. Mm-hmm. That textbook's like ancient. There's no way. I was just like, whoa, you're crazy.
There's a lot of conspiracy theories going. Yeah. Yeah.
Here's something funny, just before we finish. One of the, for lack of a better word, I'll call one of the MAGA anti-vaxxers that came to my clinic, and he got a ticket from animal control because his dog wasn't licensed or vaccinated for rabies, which is required by law. So vaccinated him, and I always try, saying, what about, you know, parvo and lepto? And he goes, oh, no, those cause autism. And I said,
In dogs.
He was absolutely serious.
An autistic dog? Is that what he was saying?
That's what he was saying.
A dog on the spectrum.
As my Catholic friend Mandy says, bless it and release it. Not worth the air.
On that note, then, we are planning on present. Yeah, we'll do that. On the 31st, it's a Thursday, the 31st of July, at 9 o'clock, and I suspect that's downtown.
It is.
Oh, yeah.
The ESC building.
Yeah.
Public service
building.
The invitation was sent out
right
to everybody, and it has the, so you all should have received it. If you didn't, let me know. Sounds like maybe you didn't. But it has the link for the WebEx, as well as, so if you can only attend virtually, as well as the location. But yes, it is at our PSC building in Suite 680.
Could you send it to me, please? Just make a note of me.
Okay.
Thanks.
And we understand you guys are really busy and have a big job. That's one of the things we may need to look at with the Board of Health, is because occasionally the council has meetings in the evening as well. Maybe we can discuss that as well. I don't know if we can add that, but once a month, I think they have their hearing at 6, don't they, Jeff?
Yes.
Oh.
Once a quarter.
And we might want, is it once a quarter? Or
once
is it,
a,
is it once,
once
a month? Or
once, it used to be once a month, but then Tuesday was evening.
And that may be something, because we know you all have jobs. I mean, one of the things I've said to them is, you know, you guys have, you know, some of you are able to use your job time to do this, but others can't. So that's something to think about as well. Potential other meeting times. It's okay to bring it up.
Mm-hmm. All right, the last thing on our agenda is updates. And the update, the local Board of Health training that Dr. Melnick was referring to is gonna be held on October 7th through the 9th in Ellensburg. And if anyone is interested in going to that, the registration's now open.
And your trip is completely paid for.
Okay, it'll be paid for, so.
Lodging, transportation, food.
You have until the 5th of September to register, so I'll make sure to include the link in the minutes, so that way you can
And if you see the email and you go to the registration, you'll see that LaFalfo is covering some of the cost, so not all the food and things are covered, but what they don't cover, CCPH will. So your trip will be completely.
Is it on the site? Does it talk about the agenda and what they're going to talk about, so somebody can look at that and see what's presentation?
I'll take a look.
Yeah, I haven't seen.
I registered already, but I'll
So that might be helpful.
I don't have my computer with
me. We do know that I'm going. Dr. Melnick's going. And two Board of Health members.
At least two.
At least two.
On the website, it says the agenda will be sent out to all registered attendees 30 days before the meeting takes place.
But it's I've been there before. It's basically going to talk about, I mean, it sounds a little bit dry, but it's going to talk about how local boards of health are structured and what their roles are. And we'll talk about the models, and that'll all be there. There'll be attorneys there as well.
So. And that'll be helpful for the future conversation with the counselors as well. So, and there'll be two of them there that you can interact with as well. So,
is it Counselor Marshall, the other one? I know Counselor Young.
I think it's Fuentes.
Oh, Fuentes. Who's in that? Who's our exhibition member?
That'll be helpful. So anyway, there'll be more. We'll keep reminding you. There's a little bit more time. So. Any other updates from council members?
We currently have 8 active wildfires burning in Washington State. We're coming at close to 100,000 acres. The nearest one to us is 11,000 in Klickitat. It's 0% contained, and the weather's getting worse the next 2 days.
Ooh.
They have 11,000 acres that are burning, They have twice that. They're under a level three go now, and there's still a couple hundred people in the level three zone who are refusing to leave. Stupidity isn't just related to the hypothetical. These are people who are smelling it, seeing it, and not leaving. Please sign up for public alerts.
And then you guys have to risk yourselves.
No, there is no level four.
So no, but are they going to have people trying to get them out
of
there?
So what we do is, so I have somebody who's doing mutual aid and click attack time, is we go out and we tell people, when you get level three, you go now because we're not coming in to get you. I've had conversations with people where I've asked them to write their social security number on their rib cage because it's the biggest part of your body and it's what you're most likely to find, so we can identify.
Do any of them have kids in there as well? And you can't go in even.
So can you legally? Yes. Are you going to risk two law enforcement officers dying in that gunfight to get those kids out of there? Yep. Mm. So in 2015, and you know Cindy Stanley, when we were deployed up to Ferry County, the sheriff of Ferry County asked her to go tell two residents that they were in level three because he knew if he sent a deputy, there'd be a gunfight. And he told her, because I was standing there, he'll point it at you, but he won't shoot you. So the point of that is, A, stupidity runs a whole bunch. B, please sign up for public alerts, crescent.wa.gov, sign up for public alerts. And if you ever hear my voice at 2:00 in the morning when your phone is ringing, leave now. Leave now.
Thanks, Scott.
I have a relative lost a house entirely in fire.
Yeah, and that's what it is. They got structure contractors, folks.
It was probably the very first house lost because it started so close to me.
So the wind will be blowing from the east, I take it. So it might even move in this direction, although it's still pretty small.
It can start getting closer through Benjamin. That's why they've got enhanced structure protection. And it gets into urban areas, and then it gets even worse.
Yeah.
So that's what happened down in California. Mm-hmm. Is when you have a roof catches on fire, you've got a nice big heavy fuel load because you got a big old piece of burning petroleum-based tile. And the wind picks that up, and it's heavy enough, and the wind can throw that for quarter, half, three-quarters of a mile. And you start getting backfires that far behind the main fire line. And that's why when it hits the urban interface, it runs like hell.
Yeah. A lot of times those, and I'm from Southern California, a lot of times those embers will blown into the eaves of the house and it burns from the inside out.
You might remember that fire a few years ago started on the Oregon side of the fireworks, started the on the Army. Yeah. The embers actually came over the Columbia and started the
Archer Mountain fire.
Yeah. Remember that? Yeah.
Yes. And that's also why, please listen to what you get from a reliable source, not the fucking news.
Not when rich.
Yeah. So we had. There's a large mountain in Oregon. We have a large mountain here. How many of you know what used to be on our large mountain? State prison. So they evacuated their large mountain, and that went out across all the news channels. The large mountain was being evacuated. First call I got was from the state director of prisons wanting to know where we were putting them. It wasn't ours. And the second was from the Clark County Sheriff wanting to know where we were putting them. It wasn't ours. So again, please check your sources. That's all I got for your wildfire awareness.
Did the weather the last 2 days help the fire at all?
Monday helped, but we only dropped about less than a half inch of rain. So really what it did was it just helped this slow down the spread. But it's dried out. And it's in a part of the gorge where you got a lot of that dry ground cover right on top of everything. And when the winds kick up tomorrow, humidity is supposed to drop below 20%. And it's going to run screaming.
And it's going to be sunny the rest of the week,
sunny,
in the 80s.
Windy, and we're looking Thursday, wind gusts 35 miles an hour.
Oh, no.
And this is still fairly early in the wildfire season.
Yeah. It's July, and we're already about two-thirds of the way through a lot of our available resources. So FEMA, bless their little pointed heads, have increased our state disaster deductible by about 7%. So now for us to get a federal disaster, we have to meet a $32 million damage instead of the old 11. So, and that's even if we can get it because of their new, so.
You know, we were feeling pretty miserable earlier in this conversation. So
oh, shit.
We just added to it.
Hey, I can give you more good news.
All right. Anybody else?
We can't top that.
No.
All right. Outside of our meeting with the Board of Health on the 31st, our next staff meeting is August 26th, and it'll be virtual. Probably like July also.